Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age and the few years surrounding it. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be discussing the girl with the million-dollar legs, Betty Grable. My newest Patreon member, Jessica, gave me a handful of fabulous suggestions of remarkable women to cover, and Betty Grable was one of them. So, Jessica, this one's for you. Elizabeth Ruth Grable was born in St. Louis, Missouri on December 18, 1916, to parents John and Lillian. John went by his middle name of Con, so that's how you'll hear me refer to him. Lillian and Con actually have quite the meet cute. They met at the iconic 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis. Con and Lillian already had 2 children when they welcomed Betty into the family, but sadly their middle child, 22-month-old John, had died from whooping cough and pneumonia. Lillian was pregnant with Betty when John died. Betty then grew up with just her one remaining sibling, her sister Marjorie, who was 7 years older than her. The Grable family was described as happy, comfortable, and all-American. Betty and her sister were thrust into a life of dance lessons, singing lessons, and music lessons, starting at the age of 4. This was at the hands of their mother, Lillian. She wanted so badly for one of her daughters to become famous. She didn't care which one, but she wanted a daughter in show business really bad. A famous daughter in show business. So she made sure that they had all their bases covered, singing, dancing, and musical talent. Well, Marjorie bowed out pretty young, not willing to give her life up to the dreams that her mother had for her. So now it was up to Betty. Lillian was strict, and she could be pretty unfair with her punishments if Betty didn't live up to her desires in her budding performing arts talents. By the time she was 7, Betty was a good tap dancer, and she could play the saxophone and the ukulele. Lillian brought Betty to every amateur show and every audition she could find. She actually appeared in some vaudeville shows with some pretty big vaudevillian names of the time. She would have her daughter do impromptu performances wherever they had an audience. Street corners, department stores, and hotel lobbies. Betty was never allowed to rest from performing for others. It's a good thing she enjoyed it, most of the time. Betty grew up mostly in a hotel apartment. The family had lived in a comfortable home in St. Louis, but Betty's mother Lillian had a pretty serious ailment with one of her hips, which made it difficult to get around and definitely difficult to maintain a home. She would require the use of a cane much of the time and was sometimes even unable to walk at all and had to use a wheelchair. Because of this, the family moved to a one-bedroom suite in the Forest Park Hotel and ate all of their meals in the hotel restaurant. And then Lillian decided she wanted to dig her stage mom claws down in Tinseltown. She convinced Con to take a family trip to Hollywood in 1929 when Betty was 12 years old. Only Lillian never intended to return to St. Louis, neither her or her youngest daughter. This was going to be a one-way trip. A one-way trip to stardom if Lillian had her way. Betty and her older sister love to reminisce about this family drive westward, especially crossing the Rocky Mountains. I'm terrified to drive through the mountains today on big, huge, safely engineered roads. But when the Grable family crossed the Rockies in their humongous, custom-built 7-passenger Lincoln, it sounded terrifying, and I simply would not have survived it. The roads were narrow, with remnants everywhere of landslides and erosion. There were no life-saving guardrails protecting vehicles from going off the edge of the most terrifying switchback roads. At every single hairpin turn in the road, Betty and Marjorie would have to take turns getting out of the massive car, running ahead to carefully check around the corner of the curve, and then clear their father when it was safe to make the curve. Can you imagine? No, thank you. Lillian Grable had quite the cushy arrangement with her husband. He would live and work in St. Louis, and he would pay for Lillian and Betty to live in Los Angeles. Con was not overly wealthy, but he did pretty well in his career as a stockbroker. I think they were upper middle class. By the sounds of it, what Lillian wanted, Lillian got. And she wanted to live in Los Angeles and push her daughter into a life in movies. And let's be honest, Con was probably happy to have her out of the house. Sister Marjorie later wanted to point out, though, that Con was not submissive to their mother's demanding and assertive ways. She said he was strong and assertive as well, but he was also warm and kind and very generous. She said it was his generosity that led him to fund his wife and daughter's new life 1,800 miles away. Lillian immediately enrolled Betty in the Hollywood Professional School, as well as dancing lessons at the Ernest Belcher Academy and acting lessons at the Albertina Roche School. Betty was 12 years old that summer she arrived in LA. She was still a kid, but she wasn't given any opportunity to be a kid in her new town. She was set to work immediately. So here they are, embarking on this brand new adventure together while Con sends them meaty checks every week. It was the summer of 1929. And do you remember what happened in October of 1929? The stock market crash. Not a great time in history to be a stockbroker. Con lost everything, but he was still able to use his sharp mathematical mind to find work, even during the Great Depression. So he managed to still fund his wife and daughter's life in LA, just maybe not so generously. Lillian could not be stopped by the Great Depression. She was on a mission to make her daughter a star. She drug poor Betty all over town every free moment she had from school, dance lessons, and acting lessons. Lillian brought her to audition after audition, entered her in countless beauty contests, knocked on doors and made phone calls, tracked down casting directors, and got her parts in small theater productions. Poor Betty. Lillian and Betty knew another girl from back home who relocated to LA to make it big, too. A girl around Betty's age named Emmeline. The girls, or more likely their mothers, decided they should put together an act together. Emmeline would dance while Betty played the saxophone. They practiced their little hearts out. But just as they were ready to take their show in front of an audience, Emmeline was offered a stage role in New York, so she left LA and headed east. This little girl ended up having a pretty successful Broadway career under the stage name of Mitzi Mayfair. Lillian didn't have to wait long for Betty's next opportunity in the spotlight. Just a few weeks after Emmeline left for New York, Betty was picked up by Fox Studios for a chorus girl gig in a movie called Let's Go Places. She was only 13 years old, but her mother had falsified the documents to reflect that her daughter was 15, which was the minimum age for chorus girl work, which still seems too young. Stage mom from hell, Lillian Grable's dreams were coming true. Her little protege was going to be in the movies. Most chorus girls blended into the chorus line in these old movies. That was kind of the objective. Well, she really blended in this film because all the girls were in blackface. But Lillian just knew that her daughter was better than all the others. She hounded the poor casting directors at Fox to give her daughter a chance in something bigger. Whether it was Lillian's demanding insistence or Betty's actual potential they saw, they offered Betty a one-year studio chorus contract. At 13 years old, Betty Grable was making $60 per week. That would be over $1,100 per week today, more than I was rolling in when I was 13. Lillian was happy. Lillian was thrilled about Betty's next chorus girl spot in her second movie, the first movie under this shiny new contract with Fox Studios. No blackface in this one. Everyone would see the beauty and talent in her daughter. And see, they did. Now that Betty was recognizable as Betty Grable, it came to light at Fox that their new chorus girl was a 13-year-old girl. Someone snitched. And there went Betty's contract and her weekly paycheck. She was fired. See what happens when you lie? Betty soon turned 14, and then she hit another casting call for chorus girls over at Goldwyn United Artists. Apparently 14 was good enough there, or Lillian lied again, because Betty was picked up for a stock chorus contract out of about 1,500 girls that were looking for the same chance. One of her first gigs with United Artists was in a Mary Pickford film, Kiki. How cool would that have been? With the sexy chorus girl life comes the flocks of men who want to get what they can, including 30-year-old actor George Raft. Lillian had a pretty tight leash on Betty, but still she encouraged the courtship between the 30-year-old man and her 14-year-old daughter, as long as she was there to chaperone their dates. Since George wasn't going to get what he wanted with eyes on him all the time, he, as he put it himself, tossed her back into the pond. We'll be seeing old Georgie again later, unfortunately. Betty's UA contract wasn't picked up for renewal after her year was up, and then it was back to square one. So then, Lillian hounded renowned bandleader Ted Fiorito into taking Betty on his band as a vocalist. This lady was good at getting what she wanted. So Betty was now a vocalist in a big band, making $70 per week, and had free room and board at the St. Francis Hotel. She stayed with the band a little under a year, some of that traveling in a Greyhound bus, with Lillian, of course, and some at engagements in LA. Now 16, the big band behind her, Betty was back looking for movie work in 1933. She got pretty regular bit parts in some mediocre films, parts like Girl on the Couch. Then she got her first co-ed role, which she would become famous for. It was a small one, in MGM's Student Tour, followed by her first featured role. And it was in a Fred and Ginger movie, The Gay Divorcee. RKO was impressed with her dance number in The Gay Divorcee, and they signed her under contract. And, of course, changed her image a little, including making her into a platinum blonde. She was rising the ranks into bigger and bigger parts. And one of her early films was partnered with another young RKO starlet, Lucille Ball, who would become her good friend. Betty was happy to be secure in a contract. And even though her parts were getting better, she was still just another stagnant actress in a sea of tons of others. Nobody seemed to really be noticing her. And then, one day, someone did notice her, more on a personal level. Former child star Jackie Coogan. He was 20 years old. Betty was 19. Betty really liked Jackie. And Lillian really liked Jackie's recognition and fame. And the rumors that he was about to come into a windfall of money from his work as a child superstar. On the arm of someone as recognizable as Jackie Coogan, Betty was soon very noticed, especially when the two got engaged. Betty's RKO contract stipulated that she could not get married until she was 21 years old, which would be on December 18, 1937. But then they dropped her contract in the spring of 1937, and the 20-year-old was free to do as she pleased. Well, as long as Lillian approved. Betty immediately secured a new contract with Paramount in May of 1937. And on November 20th, 1937, she became Mrs. Jackie Coogan, just a month before her 21st birthday. Jackie's 21st birthday had come and gone, the occasion in which he was supposed to receive his millions of dollars. His mother and stepfather had stolen his money, and a long and painful court battle would ensue. Jackie Coogan walked away with nothing but a small consolation prize after it all. His mother got away with stealing his fortune. And the icing on the cake was that his career was ruined, much to the thanks of the influence of the life ruiner himself, Louis B. Mayer. This, of course, led to the Coogan Law that protects child actors still to this day. I'll get into detail about it one day down the road. Betty Grable was riding high at Paramount as the highly visible Mrs. Jackie Coogan, who was all over the papers with this battle over his earnings. She was soon coined Betty Coed for her typecast roles in college comedies and musicals. While her career was on the rise, her new marriage was swirling down the drain. The court battles had taken a toll on Jackie, and he was in a really bad place. What money he did acquire, he blew immediately, and he was unable to get much work, just as Louis B. Mayer had promised him. All of this led to a lot of tension in the marriage, and Betty filed for divorce on July 30, 1939, just a year and a half after they said I do and looked towards a bright and rich future. Just as Betty was going through her own divorce, so were her parents. Con and Lillian decided to officially end their marriage after 31 years. Betty's next beau was bandleader Artie Shaw. Who didn't Artie Shaw date? Well, with Shaw's influence in her life, Betty now had a chance to perform under the bright lights of Broadway. And the New York theater community loved her. Well, Betty learned before too long that Artie Shaw was a huge dirtbag and was cheating on her with Lana Turner and probably tons of other women. So she dodged that bullet, but she didn't have to be lonely long because there was a long line of eligible bachelors to choose from. One such man was a pre-Lucy, Desi Arnaz. They briefly dated when Desi was performing on Broadway just before he met Lucy. Betty returned to Hollywood and continued to climb the ranks on the big screen. She was known for her hard work and her infectious laughter and optimistic attitude. She was rolling in the big bucks now. Not huge movie star bucks, but pretty nice bucks. Lillian's dreams had come true. Her little girl was a star. But she had no idea just how big that star would grow and in what way. The United States entered World War II in December of 1941 after the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, and this signaled a huge shift in everything known as normal inside of the United States. Lives changed overnight, and Betty's life would change in a huge way. First of all, George Raft was back in the picture. The relationship he tried to push when Betty was only 14 years old was now a little more appropriate now that she was 25 and he was 41. Like so many actresses during World War II, Betty Grable got right to work aiding in the war effort. She took part in war bond rallies and entertained and served at the Hollywood Canteen. She gave many servicemen one last dance before they were shipped off to war. Many of them never returned. And then her presence grew beyond the Hollywood Canteen and the war bond tours. Her image was about to be graced in the pockets and footlockers of millions of soldiers. She was about to be a world-famous pinup girl. The iconic photo was taken by a 20th Century Fox photographer named Frank Polony in 1943, and it is ranked as one of the top most popular photos of World War II. Right up there with the iconic photo of the flag rising in Iwo Jima. I'm sure most of you have seen this photograph. It is part of the cover image of this episode, but I will describe it anyways. Betty is standing straight and tall, back to the camera, hands on her hips, looking over her shoulder adoringly at the camera, wearing a white swimsuit and shimmery bronze heels, and legs for days. And, fun fact, the ankle bracelet that she's wearing in the photo was given to her by George Raft. The photo leaves very little to the imagination. And it was just the thing those brave men needed to get through the horrors of battle. It gave them hope and courage to fight their way home because maybe, just maybe, they could find a woman like Betty Grable. By the time this photo became widely circulated, Betty Grable had finally become a pretty huge star. By the end of 1942, she was ranked the 8th most popular Hollywood movie star. And she would just rise from there and remain at the top for the rest of the decade. As far as specific photo requests from U.S. servicemen, Betty Grable was by far the most requested. It is estimated that 5 million copies of this photographic shot of Betty Grable landed in the hands of GIs. 5 million. And it is also widely believed that this photo and the countless lockers it adorned was the birth of the term pinup. Betty Grable was the first official pinup girl. Betty Grable's star had now risen even higher, as high as it could. She was now number one. Those famous legs were precious assets. So precious that Lloyd's of London insured them for $1 million. I did read a lower amount than that in a different source, too. And then, in February of 1943, Betty Grable was honored with a forever imprint of her hands and feet in the cement at Grauman's Chinese Theater. And her right leg. A pair of her stockings was sold at a bond drive for $110,000. There are two reasons why I'm in show business, and I'm standing on both of them, she said. Around the time of all this fanfare, Betty ended her relationship with George Raft. He was never going to commit completely to her, and he was insanely jealous and possessive. She wanted out. Plus, she had her eyes set on a new guy. Bandleader Harry James. Betty and Harry had known each other for a while, and once she was officially free from George Raft, they began a whirlwind romance. Within just a couple of short months, on July 2, 1943, they were married in Las Vegas. Betty and Harry were incredibly happy together and relaxed into a perfect little life of wedded bliss. They wasted no time starting a family, welcoming their first daughter, Victoria, on March 3, 1944. 8 months and one day after they got married. And then she got right back to work. Betty kept popping out hits, but she always refused to accept deeper roles. She was a song and dance girl, she would say, and that's all. Her audiences wouldn't accept her in anything else. Still, she was the highest paid star in Hollywood for the years of 1946, 1947, 1948, and 1949. On May 20th, 1947, Betty gave birth to her and Harry's second daughter, little Jessica, and their family was now complete. And again, she got right back to work. Betty was flying high for the remainder of the 1940s and the first part of the 1950s. Her marriage was happy. Both she and her successful husband were rolling in dough. They had two beautiful daughters, and their careers were going great. They were blessed beyond belief. And best of all, they were happy. Until they weren't. Until the marriage wasn't so happy and Betty's career wasn't flying so high. You see, the studio she had called home for years, the studio she had made over $100 million for, was backing away a little. Betty turned 36 years old at the end of 1952, and, well, studios think that's kind of old sometimes. Foxhead Daryl Zanuck thought 36 was getting a little old, so he found himself a brand new young blonde bombshell to slide into that number one position and bump Betty Grable out in the process. Marilyn Monroe. It wasn't a nasty affair, though. Betty actually took Marilyn under her wing and they became good friends. There is a cute story about the filming of How to Marry a Millionaire, where Betty caught Marilyn about to go onto set with dirty feet and chipped toenails. She pulled her into her dressing room and gave Marilyn a pedicure herself. When their men were out of town, Marilyn was with Joe DiMaggio at the time, they would have little girls' nights in together. So it wasn't an ugly, out with the old, in with the new type of situation. Betty really liked Marilyn. Still, Betty Grable could see the writing on the wall with her future, or lack thereof, at 20th Century Fox. She still had 5 years left on her contract when How to Marry a Millionaire was filmed, but she decided she was going to bow out before she could get kicked out. On July 1st, 1953, Betty Grable entered the office of Daryl Zanuck, held up her contract, and ripped it into a dozen pieces. She stepped out of the way for her friend, Marilyn Monroe, to glide into the number one spot. Although Betty would have loved to retire right then and there from the movies, there was a problem. She and Harry were big-time gamblers at the horse track. In fact, they bred and raced their own horses. Not only that, but they had a pretty inept accountant and owed the IRS a ton of money. So she did a few lackluster movies, even one back at 20th Century Fox, and she and Harry fell into a realm they both wanted to avoid. Television. But appearing on a few popular TV variety shows was easy money. And they needed the money for the first time ever in their marriage. Betty ended up kind of liking the whole TV thing, so she stayed pretty busy with different guest appearances throughout most of the 1950s. In 1958, Harry and Betty sold their horse ranch and moved their family to Las Vegas, where they both had been doing casino shows. The once happy and content marriage was no longer very happy or content. And thinking this relocation to Las Vegas would help was a mistake. Even so, they tried. But the table games took the place of the horse races, and that wasn't good. And Harry was cheating. A lot. But Betty decided to stay unhappily in the marriage until both of her girls were 18. In December of 1962, Guys and Dolls opened for a run at the Dunes in Las Vegas, with 46-year-old Betty Grable as the lead of Adelaide. And it was the biggest show to appear at the Dunes that year. Oldest daughter Victoria turned 18 that same year, breezed through college, and then got married to her college sweetheart in the summer of 1964. Just a few months later, Lillian Grable died, right before Betty's 48th birthday. This loss came with mixed feelings, but mostly deep sadness. Yes, Lillian was kind of hard on Betty, but she was the one who had always been there for her, even if it wasn't in the most nurturing way. And now she was gone. Betty's youngest daughter, Jessica, turned 18 the following May and immediately moved out of the house. She had been rebelling against her mother's strict parenting for a couple of years and could not wait to break free and join her hippie friends in a life of freedom. Well, she got married a month after she moved out and got pregnant right away. Doesn't sound like freedom to me. Betty filed for divorce in October of 1965 and headed east to appear in Hello, Dolly! In New York before the ink was even dry. During the show's run, 49-year-old Betty Grable started dating a 22-year-old co-star. He was basically the same age as her marriage to Harry James. I don't know about that, but they were both very happy. It must have been kind of weird, though, when a few months into their relationship, Betty became a grandmother. It was exhausting work, but Betty was enjoying her work in the theater. They were doing 14 shows per week on the road with Hello, Dolly!, and then a long run in New York. And then she followed that up with a few more productions. The truth is, she kind of had to keep working. She still had a strong gambling habit, and she had expensive tastes. Betty Grable had the honor of presenting an Oscar at the 1972 Academy Awards ceremony on April 10, 1972. Following the ceremony, during all the after-show excitement, Betty started to feel a little off. And then later, she had a mild seizure. Her boyfriend Bob tried to take her to the hospital, but she refused. Finally, in the morning, when she didn't feel better, she relented. She described her symptoms to the doctor: recent dips in energy, sharp stabs of pain every now and then, and heaviness in her chest. It was lung cancer. Betty underwent chemotherapy, and it did help with the cancer in her lungs. But it was too late. The cancer had already spread to her stomach and her brain. Betty Grable was dying. During her final months, her sister Marjorie and her partner Bob were by her side night and day. And her youngest daughter returned to her life and they were able to repair their relationship. This was really, really important to Betty. Here is a really touching story about Betty and Jessica's relationship towards the end. They had talked for hours about their relationship, how Jessica had felt wronged, and the regrets that they both had. One thing Jessie told her mother that had always saddened her was the fact that she had never really had any birthday parties as a child. And that made her feel neglected and unloved. So, on May 20th, 1973, Jessica's 26th birthday, Betty threw her youngest daughter a surprise birthday party in the hospital room that she was confined to. Marjorie and Bob had helped her put it all together, complete with a big cake and decorations. This was a really happy day for both mother and daughter. Betty was gone just 6 weeks later. Betty Grable died at 5:15 p.m. on July 2, 1973, surrounded by love. She was only 56 years old. Now I would like to share some other interesting things I learned during my research. Bullet point number one. Betty's nurse had been in the room when Betty's heart stopped beating. Upon discovering her pulse was gone, she turned and walked out of the room without saying a word. But Bob, Marjorie, Victoria, and Jessica saw the tears in her eyes. They knew Betty was gone. Several days later, Betty's sister Marjorie received a letter from the nurse. In it, she apologized profusely. She wrote, quote, "I know it wasn't professional of me to break down like that, but I had been a Betty Grable fan for so many years, and then finally getting to meet her and then having to watch her die. It was just too much for me," end quote. Bullet point number two. Betty's dogs, Elsa and Cato, were her babies. I can relate to that. When she died, her partner Bob Remick kept the dogs and showered them with all of the love Betty would want for them, even a few years down the road when Bob got married and became a father. The dogs were still part of his family. Bullet point number three. Fun fact about Betty Grable's second husband, trumpeter Harry James. The recorded bugle calls played during World War II whenever a live trumpet was unavailable was him. It was part of his contribution to the war effort. Bullet point number four. Betty Grable was a sleepwalker. Lucille Ball recalled of a time that they were on tour with RKO and they were staying in a hotel. Lillian always requested a room on the ground floor, but this hotel did not have any available. So Lillian tasked Lucy with helping to protect Betty. They'd all sleep in the same room, Betty in the middle, so they could protect her if she starts moving around. Well, she did start moving around, and she went straight to the window. Lucille Ball saved her from potentially going out the second floor window. I do want to sprinkle in here that studies have proven a link between childhood stress, anxiety, and trauma with adult sleepwalking. So thanks, Lillian. In conclusion, Betty Grable was said to be hilariously funny, extremely fun to be around, a generous friend, kind to the core, and sometimes unpredictable. Lucille Ball recalled of Betty from their RKO days together, quote, "I was always sure to have a good time if Betty was there. She was the funniest person I ever knew, and everyone loved her. She had what I call kind of a kinky, curly, wonderful way of looking at things," end quote. I think that's just the sweetest compliment to her. Betty really sounded like a good person. Betty Grable always seemed to be chasing love and acceptance, though. Two things she never felt she received as a child who was pushed into a life of grueling show business. Those close to her, including her daughters, said Betty always felt a bit unsettled. She never knew what she wanted out of life. But you know, she was never given the opportunity to choose her own path. Her mother had thrust her into the life she wanted for her, starting when she was just 4 years old. A good friend of Betty's, Paula Stone, said, quote, "The little girl in Betty emerged regularly throughout her life. It was almost as if she was constantly seeking the childhood that had eluded her," end quote. Ding, spot on. As for seeking what she wanted in love, she tried marriage a couple of times, and she had happy times in each of them. But it was with the least most expecting man that she finally found the purest and most wholesome love she would ever experience. The man more than half her age. A man who you'd think hadn't experienced enough life to provide Betty with as much dignity and love and care as he did. Bob Remick. In the end, Bob showed Betty just how much he loved her. And no, he didn't receive a thing from her. He just simply loved her. Thank you, Betty Grable, for showing us grace, optimism, and kindness. And I know many, many servicemen were very thankful for you. And thank you all for listening. Now I would like to share a review of the week. I'm still holding strong with just that one negative review, so here's another happy one for you. This review is from Spotify user GirlCurlyUS. She said, quote, "Love this podcast. Erin does a fabulous job with a quick background of Golden Age stars. I look forward to the episodes," end quote. Thank you so much, Girl Curly. I tell ya, sometimes it's really hard to condense these stories into 45 minutes or less. And then other times, there's just so little source material that I'm scratching to try to fit the time. Usually, though, it's the former. There are some really, really great biographers out there who have authored the books that I use for my sources. So make sure to check them out if you want to go on a deeper dive in any of these lives. Kudos to them. Thanks to them, I can do what I'm doing. And thank you again, Girl Curly. If you want your review read on the show, drop one on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Facebook, or Instagram. And those good ratings and reviews help the show gain new listeners. And the more listeners I gain, the longer I can keep this puppy going. And if you want to access some fun bonus content, head on over to patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast to see the tiers of support available. For a small monthly fee, I will give you a ton of great bonus content. This month's bonus episode is about the history of Nickelodeons and movie theaters. So really, really fun. Head on over to patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast. My primary source for this episode was a fantastic book titled Betty Grable, The Reluctant Movie Queen by Doug Warren. I also used a book titled American Legends, The Life of Betty Grable by Charles River Editors. And of course, my own little pinup, IMDb.